This holiday season, reach for the one butter that never disappoints, Kerrygold. Made with milk from grass-fed cows on Irish family farms, it's rich, creamy, and perfect for baking. Whether browning butter for cookies or crafting the flakiest pie crust, Kerrygold's high butterfat content makes all the difference in flavor and texture. Holiday treats will taste extraordinary.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. Shopify.com/audioboom.
Let's talk.
Johnny Brown.
It's not very often that an interview drops onto my desk that my producer leaves me with. And I go, blimey, O'Reilly, I've got the collar wobbles before I even start. Because if you know me, gentle listener, I hope over the 15 years or so I've been doing this job, you know that I have a partiality to the toll. I have been known to drop in, skating away on the thin ice of a new day, just purely because it makes a darn fine cup of tea. And then, well, I'm going to take it. No, look, I went to see Toll play. I interviewed the lead singer, which was one of my most memorable interviews. I went to see them play in Malaga about 12 years ago, where I saw some of the most amazing dancing that I haven't seen since, I think, Woodstock. But there you go. He's shaking his head at the moment. He can't even remember. I'm joined by the lead guitarist, Martin. Martin, how are you, sir?
I'm very good, Giles. Thank you so much.
Good to have you. Were you on that? Were you on the Thick as a Brick tour, which was about 10 years ago, or 12 years ago?
No, Jethro Tull had stopped in its pure form and had become a two-headed monster in that year. Martin Barr Band was starting and Ian was going his own way with his version of Tull.
Right. Okay. So take me back then, Martin, back to the other, because people look at, you know, I'm from Stoke-on-Trent, okay? And people look at that particular area and go, like, Wolverhampton, Black Country, you know, the only thing that's come out of there is Jasper Carrot. But Five Fo and Fum, sir, I mean, Funky Moped notwithstanding, I mean, we've, you know, we have the Sabbath, we have the Zep, and of course we have the Mighty Toll. So explain a little bit about how you got into this whole music lark.
Yeah, well, Birmingham was a melting pot of music, and I'm sure it still is, but we have to mention the great Stevie Winwood,
yes,
and Spencer Davis Group, because those are the guys that I used to go and see in Birmingham every week, and Stevie Winwood, his voice was the same then as it is now. It's just unbelievable. And he was like 14 years old. It was just a great place for kids to... learn to play, to be able to perform in front of people. There were hundreds of gigs. So every musician had the opportunity to actually go out, get up on stage and play. And once I discovered the guitar, that's all I ever wanted to do.
So how did you discover the guitar? Is it the Burt Wilden songbook that everybody else seems to come across? Or how did you get into plucking the strings?
That was one of the elements, Burt Whedon, but it didn't hold a lot of magic. I wanted a lot more than that. I was listening to Little Richard, Jerry Lee Lewis, Eddie Cochran, Buddy Holly. I wanted American music. I wanted the American guitar licks. I wanted to play rock and roll.
You wanted to play rock and roll. So what was your, because you didn't sort of spring fully found into, oh, sorry, no, I always call it the Tull. But I mean, how did Jethro Tull come about? I mean, were you all sort of jobbing musicians and bands and then sort of, because if you look at the family history of the, if you do a history tree of who's been in Jethro Tull and hasn't, it makes sort of, I don't know, the House of Saxe Coburg look like a straight line. There are so many people coming and flying out and coming in again.
Yeah. Well, it developed. I mean, in the early days, it was just the four of us. It was a very sort of pure formula. And that's the way bands were back then, you know, the four or five guys, and you stuck together because you were young, you were hungry, and you all pretty well were on the same page musically. So, and we all went through the same stage of learning. We were just playing the hits to make. If you played in a band in England, you sort of had to toe the line with what you played. You couldn't really be out on a limb, otherwise you wouldn't get any work. But, you know, but behind it all, we're just hungry for ideas, hungry for information. And then finally when the blues came to England from America, it was always there, but when it became a big element in people's listening lives, the whole music scene came alive, and that sort of bred all the blues guitar players, Jeff Beck, Eric Clapton, Hendrix, there's so many of them. But also in parallel, me and Ian had discovered Roland Kirk, you know, the blues flute. So we were the only two guys, I believe, in the UK who were playing blues flute. And we knew of each other and heard of each other doing the same thing. And eventually we met. And, of course, we got on like a house on fire. And that was 6 months before I joined Tull.
And the thing is, I mean, blues flute in the same way perhaps that blues triangle never took off. But the thing is, it's really interesting because you've got, you know, John Mayall's, you've got Alex's Corner, and you've got John Mayall's Blues Breakers and all that sort of heavy blues scene happening in the South. But the thing with the Tull, not only are you stonking good musicians with a great blues background, and you're following the same, you know, and at the same time, we've got Peter Green's Fleetwood Mac happening, but also you've got sort of Fairport, you know, that they're happening as well. And it's a very English imagining of an, so you're not trying to be, you know, an American style sort of blues act, and then it dips into something which is the folk, almost the folk legends of England, which sort of came out of left. I mean, now it's there, yeah, of course, and people are wandering around with tambourines and the whole thing, but at the time, that family traffic and the whole thing, it was a really new, and you know, it certainly wasn't something the Americans were doing, was it?
No, but it was still compartmentalized. Mm. In as much that Tull and Spooky Tooth and John Mayall, we were the blues rock bands, and we had a circuit, we played and we listened to each other. Fairport Convention was folk music,
yeah.
And in the early 70s, the late 60s, that they didn't mix and match. I don't know, we're just narrow-minded. But much later on, of course, our musical appetite broadened and brought into those elements all into what we did.
And Spooky Tooth was that Bernie Marsden's? Was that his lot?
Spooky Tooth, or you've pinned me. It was.
I think it was.
I know who was in it, Luther Grosvenor, Mike Kelly. I don't think so, but they were a great English band, but they had a shelf life. It was a shame, but they never really expanded into Europe and America the way that other English bands did. But they were one of the great bands. The Marquee was where everybody went to see and hear bands play, and they were always on there.
So when did you migrate down to that there London then? You know, the Marquee is obviously legendary, 100 Club, all that sort of stuff, and UFO.
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
Well, but very early, because Birmingham wasn't going to give you a career in music. It was a great starting point. And I think, you know, wherever you were, Manchester, Liverpool, Birmingham, Stoke, your dream and your focus was going down to London and becoming a rock star, that's where London was that magnet for music and for new acts, new bands. I can't explain why. Well, it just was the natural melting pot. So you had to be in London to be in this, on the scene.
But what I like about this particular period, there's two things I like about this particular period of music. One is the fact that you're all bumping into each other. So you'll have seen a certain, you know, Jeff Lynne, who's, you know, or a Ron Wood who's coming down to do, Roy Wood coming down to do Wizard and then whatever, you know, The Move and that sort of stuff. And, you know, there are various members of Black Sabbath sort of hanging around at the same time. And it's so you can all catch each other's gigs. But B, because now we live in a world where it's all packaged and everybody knows what everybody else is doing, but at this point, in the business, you're making up as you go along, because there hasn't been, previous to that, you know, music has been packaged like it is now, I suppose, you know, four cheeky chaps from London, or you know, everybody's trying to be the Beatles and everybody's trying to be an American act. But with this sort of music, it is organic and they're pushing the boundaries, and it gets, you know, in the mid 70s, we're going into prog rock, etc. But, you know, it's very much uncharted territory in terms of stadium rock, the sizes that people are playing. So that must have been, you know, the lifestyle. I mean, that must have been an incredible sort of period to be, you know, at the centre of the storm, as it were.
We were really lucky, and it was a little sort of exclusive club of bands that were on the very front edge of what was happening in music, and we weren't sort of that wasn't our mode of operation. That was just where we found ourselves, and we're just sort of hungry to move on, to discover things, and we didn't want to be part of the pack, you know, like you say, the sort of manufactured music that was alien to all of these bands. And we just wanted to move forward. And we were so, Jethro Tull was such a insular band. You know, we listened to other people and we mixed, and we had friends in other bands. But we weren't influenced by them, because we just knew that we didn't want to be part of that. We had our own agenda.
What was some? I mean, what's the creative process like? Was it a benign dictatorship? Was it a socialist workers' republic of songwriting? I mean, how did it work out, Martin?
No, it was very much a four-piece band, and then, you know, five-piece when John Evans joined, and you know, I mean, Ian's a great songwriter. You know, I'm playing his music now, and we're on tour, and I play a song, One White Duck, and I'm like, still in awe of what a great song it is, or Life is a Long Song. You know, we're doing an acoustic tour, and they're fantastic songs, and he was coming up with them. I wasn't writing songs. Clive Bunker wasn't writing songs either. But it was an environment where if somebody had an idea or some inspiration, it could go into the pot and be used. So there was no pecking order. We're four guys in the back of a van, and we shared everything.
One of the things is the fact, again, like, you know, the back of the van. A lot of, you know, I know people have gone back to touring now because it's the only way they can sort of make money after the, thanks very much, streaming services. But, you know, at that time, sort of mid-60s to basically mid-70s, 80s, there's an awful lot of touring going on, isn't there? There's an awful lot of touring for all the groups.
Yeah, but we thrived on it. You know, we loved doing it, and the most exciting aspect of it, excuse me, was to go to new territory. So we were one of the first bands to go to South America, one of the first bands to go to Australia, Japan, New Zealand, you know, into Eastern Europe. You know, at the time when it was communist countries, but it was just fantastic, because the kids there knew our music, and they were desperate to hear Western music, and so the whole atmosphere, it was electric, you know, literally electric, and that was our lifeblood. We toured, we worked every week of every year.
When I talk to musicians, I'm lucky enough to do this on a regular basis, but I talk about the live experiences being about connection. If you stood on a stage and you're playing in front of an audience, if it goes well, there is no greater rush than the connection between yourself as an artist and your audience. And I should imagine in an Eastern European country, it's not only the connection, it's the release that these people haven't had and haven't been able to experience before. And so it must have been coming at you in waves, Martin.
It was wonderful. And of course, the reality of the situation was that the first time we went to South America, we played to 25, 30,000 people every night.
Wow.
But then I think other bands, we were the guinea pigs. So if we got out of South America, got paid, and our gear was still in the packing cases, other bands said, okay, it works, we can go there. So within a short period, everybody went there. So the next time we played there, we weren't playing to music fans, we were playing to Jethro Tull fans. And so a smaller audience, I mean, 5,000-10,000 people, they were just desperate to hear Western music, whoever it was. And that was that first wave.
I just want to ask you this question. It just struck me. When you went to South America, right? So what were you doing? Brazil? Were you doing what countries were you doing in South America?
Oh, I can't remember, but definitely Brazil. Definitely. Yeah. I mean, I'd have to.
Well, we'll start. The question is, did you leave South America with the same amount of roadies that you entered South America with? Or did a couple of them sort of fall by the wayside?
Yeah. I've got stories that I can't tell live on air. But it was extreme. Nothing was normal that happened in South America. It was like being, you know, on the Western frontier, you know, in cowboy country.
What about Japan? Because I mean, they tend to scream a lot. Do they, Japanese audiences, when you come on stage? Did you have that, or did they actually sit back and listen to the music? Because I've heard people like even listen to Cheap Trick, that live album that Cheap Trick have, and it's just, you can just about make out the band from the whole way through. So did you actually have like a Japanese Jethro Tull face sort of fan base?
Well, yeah, we did, but.
okay, this is good.
You know, it's. I'll tell you one little funny story. We were popular in Japan, but we were taking the bullet train from one town to another, and we were sort of pumped up with the reception, and we're thinking, yeah, we're doing really great here, and we got off. We're traveling to some big town, I can't remember where, and as the train pulled into the platform, there was a sea of young girls, and they're all like looking at the train. We go, oh my goodness me, wow, here we go, guys, this is great. So we get off the train, and they all run straight past us, and there's like a Japanese band, three carriages down. They're all going, ah! They completely ignored us. Prague is different in Japan.
What was the studio experience like? Did you go in with some clear ideas of what you're going to do? Because again, this is a time when technology is changing at the same time. So, you know, you think of, you know, obviously Pink Floyd with Dark Side of the Moon, they pushed about, you know, every hi-fi salesman's dream was that album. Look, stereo sound, people. Did you find that a hindrance or was it a help? I mean, were you trying to do something completely different from the live experience?
Well, I think essentially we're just trying to get what we did onto tape as pure as possible. You know, we weren't looking for the gizmos and the weird side of it. It was just purely our music going from A to B with the least amount of processing possible. So what the mic heard is what you heard on record. But, you know, I always think of early studio days that it turned around. Because we were almost naive going in there. We didn't know how anything worked, and we're in awe of the studio engineer, the producer, the tape operator. These were all guys that did things we knew nothing about. So so that they were sort of in control, although we knew what we wanted, but they were the guys that made it happen, that enabled us to make records. And of course, it slowly turned round. And later on in the Tull's career, that the studios got bigger and bigger and more expensive. And that glass window between the control room and the studio got thicker and thicker. and then I built my own studio. And I thought, you know what? It's really easy. That whole magic and aura of not understanding and not communicating about the process is rubbish. It's really easy to do, and it's great fun as well. So recording, as it has done, has turned completely round, where if you've got a computer and a room, you can make a record, and good. I think that's a healthy way to be.
What, Aqualung? I mean, what was that? I mean, that I get a, you know, I've been hanging out in Spain, I've been living in Spain since the mid-80s, and that was the album. You need to just play the first couple of bars on that, and people know, it doesn't matter what country, they know exactly what we're talking about here. What's that like to you know, if you listen to people's reaction to that, even now, some years later? I mean, it must be an incredibly satisfying feeling to think, you know, that's me on the, you know, that's me on the jukebox.
Yeah, it's a double-edged sword, because you want to play it, yet you don't want to play it.
Yeah.
So it's your best friend and your worst enemy. And you know, I still enjoy playing it, otherwise I wouldn't do it. I mean, I'm in the luxurious position of being the band leader, and I do the set lists. So it has a power of communication, and that is a wonderful thing. But, you know, musically, I wouldn't say it's the most important piece of music I play on any particular night. So I respect it.
Yeah.
And I respect people want to hear it and hold it in high esteem. But I put it into perspective.
It's interesting because I went to see a guy called Mark Ward, who was one of the guitarists of from the Black Crowes, and he left the Black Crowes for various reasons in the 90s. And he did a concert down here, and checked with some Spanish guys afterwards, and they said, "Oh, but he didn't play any Black Crowes." And it was like, "No, because he's not the Black Crowes anymore. He's moved on." So when people come to see, you know, Martin Barr's show now, I mean, it's not a question of pumping out the, you know, you're not a Jethro Tull tribute band, are you? In the nicest possible way.
Well, I am, really.
Right.
And so is Ian, you know, because you're only, you know, 1 centimetre away from being a tribute band. To be honest about it. But then, you know, I sort of own that music not literally, but I played Jethro Tull's music for 55 years, 50 years. I can't work it out. But me and Ian played together for 43 years. And that's a heritage, you know, that is in my blood. I feel that I have the right to promote that music, that brand. Every guitar riff, every guitar chord is me, and that's indelible. So, yeah, I could go and play Jethro Tull all night, and I'm completely qualified, and I have the right to do it. It's my music, they're my guitar parts, and they always will be. And I'm proud of it. And as I said a minute ago, I only play the music I want to play. So I mix it in. And we've always done that. And then some told music, you know, I embrace it and change it. And sort of add my only modern ingredients to it. So it's always great.
So
that's the qualification.
When it comes to writing the autobiography, did you think, okay, the time has come now, you know, to put this down to paper, or to put keyboard to laptop, as it were?
Yeah, well, there's the elements about Jethro Tull that I was aware of is there's so much information available, that there's so much being written about Tull. And I sort of avoided the area where you're just talking about gigs, tours, albums, the sort of the bones of what Jethro Tull is, because everybody knows about it and it's readily available. But the thing I wanted to talk about was how I started, how I was a gangly, spotty, naive 14-year-old in Birmingham, but with no personality and no motivation. How I figured out my life, what I wanted to do, and how I did it, because that is unique. Because nowadays people don't go through the same process anymore.
When you talk to Tull fans, I mean, they are a bunch of people like no other, aren't they? I mean, you can, like I said, I saw this thing a couple of years ago, and the number of bangles and little bells and beads and strange bandana wearing folk. I mean, it is sort of sometimes it can be a bit like, you know, crashing backwards into a medieval fair.
Well, they're very different, and you know, when you ask me about where I played in South America, I guarantee any gig I play or Ian plays, if you ask the audience that question, half of them would know the answer. You know, it's this huge library of information, but it's sort of, I take that for granted in a way that the actual details aren't vital to what I do. You know, to quote a horrible pun, I don't live in the past.
Oh, indeed, yes, that's very good. Yes, yes.
Isn't that horrible? Yes, sorry, yes, about, yeah, that. but, you know, I'm more interested in what I'm doing today. I'm talking to you. I'm talking about things that are important to me. Last night I played a gig and it was fabulous. Tonight I'm playing a gig and I hope that's going to be fabulous as well. And then I'm thinking about what I'm going to be doing next year. It's always looking forward.
Isn't that the wonderful thing though? Because your career has allowed you to do that. And you know, millions and millions of people don't have that, you know, haven't been able to have the opportunity. And yet you can go and you can play every night in a gig and you connect with people and it means something to people, Martin.
Yeah, well, at the moment I can, and then the day that I can't, I will stop because I have to play live music. I like to entertain people. I love playing guitar and I love playing my flute, but I would never be that tribute band because then you're just looking backwards, and I've never been a person to do that. I think Ian's the same. He respects the history and uses it as a tool to go forward. And that's certainly the way I am.
The book is called A Trick of Memory. It's by Martin Barber speaking today. Listeners, you can go onto our own virtual bookstore, click on the photograph, and you'll see the man himself in full flow in some rather splendid trousers as well, striped trousers. Martin, do you do the social media thing? Have you got a website?
I have a website, but my Facebook got hacked.
Oh no! Oh no!
it was vicious. So I'm sort of building it back up again. I don't do it personally because if I have a minute in the day, I pick my guitar up, and so that's my priority. I love life, and my life is more of an active one. You know, I go running, I play tennis. I like to do a lot of things that make life vibrant, but music is my go-to occupation, and I want every minute available to play music.
The book is called A Trick of Memory. It's by Martin Barry. Speaking to you today, Martin, thank you so much for your time today.
You're very, very welcome. Thank you.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds, or Skims. Sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
This holiday season, reach for the one butter that never disappoints, Kerrygold. Made with milk from grass-fed cows on Irish family farms, it's rich, creamy, and perfect for baking. Whether browning butter for cookies or crafting the flakiest pie crust, Kerrygold's high butterfat content makes all the difference in flavor and texture. Holiday treats will taste extraordinary.